Okay, well, it's already 9 o'clock, so I'm going to start. For those who are interested, here is a picture, since we're doing the Chatam Sofer. Here is the picture of his grave. It's underground. I mentioned last class that there's about 30 different graves that were saved when they destroyed the cemetery. There's a long story, but I can't go into it now. You can see on the left Rabbi Kelman and some others. It really is a sight to behold. I'm going to close that up now. Let us begin. Before we start, there's just a few things I want to say. Catch up while people are still signing on. A few things from last semester. We spoke about study of Talmud in Korea, and a number of people mailed me stuff about that. By now, I think you probably all know, so I don't need to repeat it, that Talmud is studied by everyone there. Not Talmud the way we study it, but more of like wisdom of the Talmud. Relevant to classes we did in previous semesters, we dealt a lot with Rabbi Nachman Adler. Take a look at this giant volume that comes out twice a year called Yeshurin. It's almost 1,000 pages. And in the last issue, there's an article by Rabbi David Kamenetsky about Frankfurt and Rabbi Nachman Adler. And for those who are interested, I know many were, he wants to argue that the real reason for the Cheirem that was put on Rabbi Nachman Adler, we spoke a good deal about this, was not the different minyanim, not the fact that he had women wear tzitzis, all these other things we spoke about, but that Rabbi Nachman Adler, on his own, put a member of the community into Cheirem. And that went against all policy. So, and finally, we had classes on Rabbi Tzvi Pesach Frank, so I want to call your attention to this volume. Actually, two volumes dealing with Rabbi Tzvi Pesach Frank. I'll just mention there's all sorts of interesting stuff. It's a hagiography, but as with all hagiographies, there's good stuff you can get out of it. They tell a story in volume 1, page 106, which I think some will find interesting, that when Rabbi Tzvi Pesach Frank went to Jerusalem, not Rabbi Tzvi Pesach Frank, the Aderis, Rav Kook's father-in-law, he was surprised because in Russia, for example, you have you can have great Talmidei Chachamim who wear regular clothing. They don't wear rabbinic garb. And he comes to Jerusalem, and he finds that people who are complete ignoramuses are wearing rabbinic garbs. So he doesn't know whether he's supposed to stand up for someone or not. And the reason I think that's interesting is because I think we see it in our life as well. I'm looking at my picture here. I know people have asked me about the light. There's a light right on top of me, so I can't turn it off or I won't see. That's what's reflecting on me. So getting back to the Aderis, when I was growing up, figure in the 1970s, the only people who wore yeshiva garb would have been rabbis and people in yeshivas. So you saw someone in yeshiva garb, you assume that he was a bit of a Talmud Chacham. Today, it is not unusual to find Balei Tshuva, to find people who don't know anything even, who wearing yeshiva garb. And I'm sure that most of us have had circumstances where we see someone dressed the part, as they say, and you start speaking to him and you see he doesn't know anything. So that's just exactly what was the case 100 years ago in Jerusalem. Okay, finally, I mentioned last class, I quoted Rabbi Akiva Joseph Schlesinger as saying that there were real reformers in Pressburg in the Chatham Sofer's time who on Tisha B'Av ate in public opposite the Chatham Sofer's house as a means of showing how much they opposed him. And I asked, could that really be true? And subsequently, I found that the Chatham Sofer writes in his responsa that there were no Sabbath violators in the whole city of Pressburg. He had opponents. We spoke about the opponents, but these were, I guess you would say, liberal Orthodox Jews. But the Chatham Sofer himself tells us that there were no Sabbath violators. So I think we have here another example of Rabbi Akiva Joseph Schlesinger's exaggerations. Okay, let us move on. We're going to focus today on the Chatham Sofer's great significance in the Reform movement, in the battle against the Reform movement. He was a leader in this. He really determined to a large extent how this battle would play out. His influence is still very noticeable. If you followed the controversy last year, or actually earlier this year, with Rabbi Shlomo Miller of Toronto, the way he attacked Rabbi Michael Broyd for being too liberal, in his opinion, he referred to him as Acher. We are going to see who this Acher is and why, in the Orthodox world, to call another rabbi Acher, alluding to Elisha ben Avuya in the Talmud, who's a heretic, but there's another Acher that we'll speak about today. This all goes back to the battle of the Chatam Sofer. The Chatam Sofer had a no-prisoners attitude when it came to reform. He writes that when he attacks the reform, he doesn't deal with people. He only deals with ideas. And yet the truth is that's not correct. That is the case most of the time, but there were times that he actually attacks individuals. One of them is so-called Acher, Aaron Chorin. Aaron Chorin, I think you can refer to him as the first reform rabbi, signs his name Aaron Chorin Rabiner, which the anagram of that is Acher, alluding to the great heretic that Milton Steinberg wrote the book about, Elisha ben Avuya. He also called him Sitra Chorina, the other side, is Sitra Acher. We'll talk more about him. Now, it could be that the Chatam Sofer was too extreme. Some of you might have that opinion. I mentioned already that Rabbi Soloveitchik wondered if the Chatam Sofer had not been so extreme in his response, if the reform movement could have been prevented. At the beginning, as we will see, the demands of the reform were not so extreme. So it's very possible that a compromise could have taken place. But Rabbi Soloveitchik also concludes that had the Chatam Sofer not been so extreme in his response, perhaps matters would have been a lot worse. Now, the fact that we're going to speak about the Chatam, actually, let me speak Ashkenazic, the Chatam Sofer, as the leader of the battle against reform is itself significant. Let's not forget that there were people better known than the Chatam Sofer who participated in this battle, that is better known at the time. The first attack against the reform appeared in this book, Ela Divrei Habrit, a book that we'll speak about. And in this book, you find, as I said, people better known than the Chatam Sofer. Rabbi Mordechai Bennett, chief rabbi of Nicholsburg and of Moravia. Rabbi Jacob of Lissa, the Nesivos, and others. The Chatam Sofer was not the senior rabbi of his time when the reform movement got off the ground and when this book was published in 1819. Yet more than anyone else, the Chatam Sofer would set the stage in his response to how traditionalists would deal with the innovators. Now, the Chatam Sofer at first thought that there should be no response against the early reformers, who we're going to speak about soon, because that would just lead to a dispute in print and eternalize the dispute. The Chatam Sofer thought that people might just forget about the reformers. That's not what happened, though. The other rabbis thought that it was important to publicly respond. Now, to appreciate this contribution of the Chatam Sofer, we need to understand what Reform Judaism at its beginning was all about. If all you know about Reform is today, you're going to find the early Reform very different. In fact, some of you might not even think of it as Reform at all. It is a Reform that's still bound to Halakha. And many Orthodox Jews today would be very comfortable with the reform in the early 19th century. And much of modern Orthodoxy, actually, you could say, reminds you of this early reform. It's a reform that uses halakha to move forward and make changes. It's a short-lived reform. It's a reform for not even one generation. And the later reform, the next generation of reform, really had no interest in what the earlier generation of reform was advocating. But it's still important to look at this first generation, half a generation of reform, and the early Talmidei Chachamim who helped open the floodgates of the next generation where we get people like Geiger and Holtheim. Now, at the very beginning of Michael Meyer's book on the history of Reform Judaism, he points out that the word is not reformed, that is, ED, with an ED ending. The word is Reform Judaism. That's so because, by the way, the term, incidentally, is not necessarily the best term, as we'll see, but it's become known as Reform Judaism because it is a movement that is dynamic, that is constantly moving. The reason I say it's maybe not the best term, especially at the beginning, because not all of those who advocated religious reforms thought of their position as Reform Judaism. It's only in retrospect that we do. So when does the movement begin? Some people have pointed to Moses Mendelssohn even as an early reformer, but that's not correct. Definitely not correct. But it is an early 19th century movement. Now, why do I say early 19th century movement? In the interest of time, and because this is not a class on the development of reform, I'm really going to skip a lot of the ideology of the reform movement. I'm only going to speak about it in as much as it's relevant to the response of the Chassam Sofer. And I'm not going to get into it all in these lectures with the second generation of reform. However, let's begin with the year 1700. Because I just said that reform movement can be dated from the early 19th century. And yet we know that already from the early 1700s, halachic observance in Germany was declining. Jewish institutions were becoming weaker. Almost none of the rabbis were German trained. We know that by the mid-18th century, very few boys were receiving a decent Jewish education, and the girls were receiving almost none. So isn't this a sort of reform? That's actually the case that was made in a book published more than 40 years ago by Israel Shochet. It's called In Chilufei Tkufot, In the Changing of Eras, in which he wants to show, based upon the decline in religiosity from the year 1700, you can look at sermons and everything else, and you can show that the average Jew was not really as religious in the year 1700 as the year 1600. The rabbis are criticizing Sabbath violation. They're criticizing shaving with razors. They're criticizing eating in non-kosher restaurants when people travel. They're criticizing all sorts of things. So therefore, Shochet argued that we have to date the beginnings of Jewish modernity. Jewish modernity usually understood as a time in which Jewish law is no longer as significant. Normally dated the beginning of the 18th to the end of the 18th century. He argues, therefore, we have to look at it, the beginning of Jewish modernity, from the beginning of the 18th century, 1700. Yet, this position was rejected pretty much unanimously, most forcefully, by Jacob Katz in his book, Out of the Ghetto. Katz's point is that the issue is not the facts adduced by Shochet. Shochet brings all sorts of facts. It's their significance as an indication of change. Were these new phenomena, that is, the fact that more Jews were violating basic Jewish law, were these variations or deviations from the traditional pattern, or were they elements of a new process that would ultimately lead to a new structure of society? In other words, what's the mental attitude of the person in the year 1700 who's no longer so observant? Is he violating halakha because of new outlook on life? Does he feel on Yom Kippur that he needs to atone for his sins? Are we dealing with someone with a new outlook who rejects rabbinic authority, or rather with someone who's a sinner, who's being more lenient on various matters, but who recognizes that he's sinning and that come Yom Kippur he's going to have to sin, he's going to have to repent? And there is absolutely no question that in the year 1700 there is no new mental attitude. We simply have more sinners. And you can see the same thing in Catholic society as well. You can look at traditional Catholic society and you find all sorts of sinners. And yet these were still people who thought that they would have to repent for their sin, or they thought they'd be punished for their sin. By the time you get to the mid-18th century, and certainly by the beginning of the 19th century, there's a completely new mental attitude, a rejection of rabbinic authority, a rejection of Judaism. Now, in the 18th century, the rabbis no longer have the authority to control the sinners. That is, it's illegal in Germany to put people under the ban. The bans wouldn't work anyway. You now have a non-Jewish society that is much more hospitable. You have many liberals by the mid-18th century who are saying, we are very happy to welcome Jews into our society, as long as they're not observant Jews and they want to assimilate with us. This is important because when the first reformers arrive on the scene in the early 19th century, you already have more than 50 years of what you can call a neutral, or at least a semi-neutral civilization, or semi-neutral society, by which I mean that whereas in the year 1700 or 1600, you were either Jewish or Christian, by the mid-18th century, there was an element, there was a neutral society in Germany. Without converting to Christianity, you could still participate in much of the culture and intellectual life of German high society on a relatively neutral ground. So you have Jews who are really not part of the Jewish society, are not part of Christian society, but exist in a sort of secular lifestyle. So why do I say that this is important? Because here you have a movement coming on the scene that is really focused on these Jews who have very little Jewish connection and yet do not want to convert to Christianity. And this new Reform Judaism is going to give them some Jewish connection. Going to give them some synagogue, some Jewish life. When you look at it this way, it's hard not to see the Reform movement, although we're not accustomed to think of it this way in traditional society, it's hard not to think of the Reform movement as actually keeping some people in the Jewish fold for another generation or two. In other words, it's not like the Reform movement is really preaching to the observant Jews and taking Jews from observant society and bringing them into Reform society. Reform Judaism is coming on the scene for those Jews who have no Jewish connection. And obviously at the time of the battle against Reform, when Reform is advocating all these things from some later generation, they are advocating getting rid of Shabbos, getting rid of Brit Milah, all sorts of things. You can understand the attacks on Reform. But just looking at it in retrospect, if you look at it historically, you have to raise the question, was the Reform movement a cause of assimilation, or was it actually something that slowed assimilation down maybe a generation or two? And that would cause you perhaps to have a more tolerant attitude in retrospect, and I think the parallel is obviously the situation today. We know that the Orthodox spokesmen like to attack the Reform and conservative as leading to assimilation and leading to mixed marriages. But I wonder, is that true? Or is it really just the opposite in America? If you didn't have the conservative movement, let's say, or the Reform movement, would these people become the non-observant Orthodox? In which case, you could say that the Reform and conservative movement are a negative force, because if we didn't have them, these people, obviously, they won't become Orthodox. You're never going to have a majority of Jews in America, Shomer Shabbos, but they would become maybe the non-observant Orthodox, like the old-fashioned Orthodox, because we would be the only shuls there would be, maybe like in a Sephardic society, and therefore we could influence their children to go to day schools. Maybe. Or maybe not. Maybe these Jews would simply think of the Israelis who come to America and have no connection. Maybe these Jews would simply assimilate, and the conservative movement and the Reform movement are really keeping these Jews connected to some form of Judaism for another generation or two. Compare the secularists in Israel who have no Jewish connection in terms of religion versus the conservative and Reform Jews in America that have some Jewish connection. And the Orthodox movement benefits a great deal from the Baalei Tshuva that come out of the conservative movement in particular. So you have to ask yourself, really, are these movements really a benefit, not just for Judaism as a whole, but for the Orthodox in particular? In any event, by the time you get to the year 1800, while you still have traditional Judaism in the small towns in Germany, in the big cities, the Reform is very strong. by the first generation of the 19th century, they're really dominating in the big cities. And we see by the year 1800, reform services opening. You have reform services, for example, in Germany. These reform services, incidentally, men and women do not sit together. This is a common mistake. Men and women sitting together is an American innovation. In Albany, from Isaac Mayer Wise, in Germany, the men and women always sat separately. But you have, at the beginning of the 19th century, the first reform congregation. And they did all sorts of things. They read the Torah in Sephardic Hebrew. They had a great attraction to the Sephardim. They thought that they were more liberal and open-minded than the Ashkenazim. The preachers, they had weekly sermons. Remember, sermons, as we've spoken about, is a Christian thing. They sang German hymns with a choir. They had an organ played by a non-Jew. They used to call people up by name, not by name, they called them up by number, first person getting aliyah. There weren't really any real great violations of halakha. In terms of the ideology used, there were two prayer books in the early Reform. They did omit passages calling upon God to gather to disperse from the four corners of the earth, but they did retain the prayers for sacrifices, incidentally, and for references to the chosen people. In Berlin, there was a great deal of controversy. The traditional Jews were able to get the government to shut down this minyan. It was regarded as an inappropriate minyan, an improper minyan, and according to the rules in those days, there's not like today where you have all these shtiebels. A private synagogue could not operate without the community's permission, so the government shut it down. But then it was held in a private home. That could not be shut down. And then when the communal synagogue was closed for repairs, the government gave permission for the synagogue. Actually, let me correct myself. At first it was shut down in the house. And then when there was no longer a main synagogue in Berlin, the government gave permission for these private synagogues, the private synagogue in the house. Now, these early reformers in Berlin, they hired a Hungarian Jew to come up with a book and to gather opinions in support of their reforms. The name of the book was called Noga HaTzedek. Here is the title page of it. The man's name was Eliezer Lieberman. He published this book in two parts. The first part is Oren Oga, which is his responsum. The second part is Noga HaTzedek. Noga HaTzedek has four responsa. We will not get into these four responsa, but three of the four rabbis were respectable rabbis, two Italian rabbis, one Hungarian rabbi, Moshe Kunitz, and then Aaron Chorin. Aaron Choriner, the rabbi of Arad in Hungary, who at this time was also a respectable rabbi. We'll get back to this in a minute. It's a very important historical work. This book is the first defense of reform in the face of attacks. It's designed to show that there's nothing halachically improper with the reforms in Berlin. What were the reforms? The most extreme reform in Berlin was the playing of an organ by a non-Jew on Shabbos. This was very important, this book, because the Orthodox, they weren't even called Orthodox then, but we're calling them Orthodox, went to the government to argue that this new synagogue is a sectarian institution. And if it is sectarian, then the government would have to shut it down, because Judaism was a tolerated religion. But if they could show that Reform Judaism is not a form of Judaism, it's sectarianism, it's a cult, then it would be shut down by the government. So therefore, the point of this book was to show that this is a part of historical Judaism. This idea that you use the government to shut the reformers down was tried in Hamburg, it was tried everywhere the Orthodox thought they could. It's only in the next generation that Hirsch, Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, said that this is the wrong approach. And he didn't just say that as a means of cynical approach. By what I mean that because the reformers were in control of the communities in the mid-19th century, Hirsch believed as a matter of principle that we don't force people to be observant, but the early rabbis were unanimous that if you can use the government to shut down the reformers, shut them down. Let me briefly speak about Noga HaTzedek. The big issue in Noga HaTzedek is music on Shabbos. We know that there was already music played in Italy. That's one of the reasons why they wrote to these Italian rabbis. The Italian rabbis didn't understand the situation, what Reform Judaism was. They were asked certain questions. Is it permissible to play an organ on Shabbos if a non-Jew does it? Now, this was already done in Italy. Not only that, in Prague, they played an organ on Shabbos with a non-Jew. If you think of it, what could be the problem playing an organ? By the way, in Italy, until the 1960s, the traditional synagogues in Italy, in places like Rome and in Florence, played an organ on Shabbos with a non-Jew. What could be the problem, the halachic problem, in playing an organ on Shabbos? All you have to do is open up the Shulchan Aruch and you can see that the old practice used to be to have weddings on Friday afternoon. This made a lot of sense because then you'd have a feast and you'd invite everyone, including the poor people, to your wedding feast. Everyone got a nice Shabbos meal. But if you look in the commentaries there, they describe how the practice was to have the simcha Friday night, the wedding simcha Friday night, with non-Jewish musicians playing music. And this is found in every Shulchan Aruch in the world. Now I ask you, if you decide to have a wedding on Friday afternoon, or have a bar mitzvah on Shabbos, and have non-Jewish Jews come in and play instruments, what do you think people's response is going to be? That they won't get it. They'll think you're definitely a reformer. And yet this was the practice by traditional Jews going back for many, many years before the reform, that you'd have wedding celebrations with non-Jewish musicians playing for you on Shabbos. So what could be the problem? It's a simcha of mitzvah. We know that non-Jews do all sorts of things for us on Shabbos. They used to turn the candles off in the shul and do other things. So that's one problem. The other issue is that in the synagogue in Berlin, later in Hamburg as well, they recited various prayers in the vernacular. It's also going to be an issue. But what could be the problem with that? The Mishnah is clear that you can recite prayers in any language you want. So these are, on the one hand, halachically, there doesn't seem to be any problems. On the other hand, it was obvious to the Chatam Sofer more than anyone, but to the other rabbis as well, that all these so-called halachic reforms were simply the first step to a complete revolution, of what Judaism is all about. He understood this very clearly, and history bore this out. The question is, though, how do you refute so-called reforms that can be justified halakhically? The next rabbi, the rabbi who I'm going to speak about briefly, because he becomes the focus of so much of the Chassid Sofer, is Aaron Chorin, who wrote the third responsum in this book. Now, Aaron Chorin was a bit controversial even before this. He was a student of the Notab Yehuda of Prague. He was a great Talmud Chacham. Why was he controversial? He's controversial because he was the great defender of the Notab Yehuda's permission to eat sturgeon. You know that sturgeon is kosher. The Notab Yehuda famously permitted sturgeon. And this then created a dispute. Chorin wrote two books defending his teacher's permission. And not only did he write these two books, in there he has letters from the Notab Yehuda's son and Elazar Fleckelis, the Tshuva Me'ava, and a big Rabbanim in Budapest. So it's not like he was alone on this. However, since sturgeon was a great dispute, you already had certain rabbis, such as Mordechai Bennett and others, who didn't like Chorin because they thought that Chorin, instead of defending his permission for Sturgeon, should have acknowledged that his teacher, the Noda Behuda, was mistaken. Now, today, no one eats sturgeon. And whenever I speak about this issue, I even wrote about it, I like to show, however, that this, although sturgeon was said to be kosher in Prague, sturgeon was also eaten in the United States up until World War II. What's my proof of this? I'm going to show you something right now. Here I have, I'll get back to this. The Agudas Rabbanim of America, which was the organization of the European Rabbanim, not the American Rabbanim, they published in Hapardes, they published this a number of times in the 1930s, a list of which fishes were kosher. And notice, I don't know how to use my, I think I've got my pointer here, right here. Well, first of all, notice swordfish. This should not surprise you at all. Swordfish was eaten up until Rabbi Tendler said, determined it wasn't kosher. Swordfish to this day is eaten in places like Turkey. It's eaten in Italy. It's also eaten in the land of Israel, in Eretz Yisrael. It was permitted by the Rabbanut until the 1970s. And when Rabbi Zivotofsky, he hasn't been to Toronto yet, but he does his halachic suda. You can learn about it, and he comes to shuls and speaks about it. He got the Rabbanut to give permission. I could show you a picture, maybe next class, of him holding a swordfish at the halachic suda they have in Jerusalem. They served swordfish last year, and there still is a restaurant in today, I think in Eilat, he told me, that still gives permission for swordfish. But the Rabbanut of Jerusalem, although they generally do not do swordfish, they agreed to matur swordfish, and there's plenty of poskim. Rabbi Mahpud, Rabbi Soloveitchik thought swordfish was kosher. And according to Zivotofsky, Rav Schechter to this day thinks swordfish is kosher. So that's very controversial both ways. But sturgeon, today no one eats sturgeon. And yet look over here. Sturgeon is on the list, two types of sturgeon, I don't know the difference, of kosher fish from the Agudas HaRabbanim in the 1930s. And based on this, I know we probably have some Yiddish readers here. Here was an ad that appeared over and over again in the Hapardes. It's talking about how the sturgeon is found on the Rishima, the list of the Agudas HaRabbanim, for a kosher fish, which you can eat, and it's a very tasty fish, good geschmack and good to eat. And you see the pasuk from the Torah that describes fishes and fins and scales. So, and Hapardes is not the liberal Orthodox journal. Hapardes was the right-wing yeshivish journal. And so here you have the proof. Now, as I said, sturgeon, after World War II, it was no longer eaten. The Agudas Rabbanim changed its position, but swordfish still was eaten. And anyone who's interested in swordfish, and Rabbi Zivotofsky has a very long article on the topic. So Chorin is a main defender of, as I said, of the music and of playing on Shabbos and of playing music on Shabbos and of davening in the vernacular, also abolishing Shmoneh Esrei. They abolished the style in Shmoneh Esrei in this Reform synagogue. But what was their source for this? The Rambam. No other than the Rambam abolished the repetition of the silent Shmoneh Esrei because of all the talking. And Chorin cites this. In terms of the Sephardic pronunciation, Chorin cites Rabbi Nassan Adler, who adopted the Sephardic pronunciation. And it goes on and on. So I'm going to skip a good deal about this book. There's, if we do more classes, I spoke about the early Reform movement, I can come back to this. But I do want to now move to the Chatzim Sofer, because the Chatzim Sofer has a couple of responses in this book, Ela Divrei Habrit, that has the responses of all the great rabbis of the time. The Chatzim Sofer's responses are quite significant. By the way, in one of the Chatham Sofer's letters here, Aaron Chorin acknowledges his mistake, his error, and he repents. But it wasn't long before Aaron Chorin returned to his old ways, becomes a radical reformer. Eventually, he even permits violation of Shabbos, and by the end of his life, he supports the decisions of the second generation of Reform rabbis in Germany. And in the Orthodox literature of the time, he's not even mentioned by name. He's called Acher. And that's why when Rabbi Miller calls someone Acher, that's what he's referring to. Now, the Chasam Sofer's most famous pun in his battle against the Reform is Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. Everything that is new is forbidden by the Torah. This is going to be a way how you can explain why even things that are halachically permissible are really forbidden because they're new. In this book, Eilat Divrei HaBrit, he never quotes this pun, which becomes his favorite pun. That's because when he penned his replies in this book, he hadn't yet come up with it. He came up with it in a tshuva dated 1819 when this book was published, but his responsa in this book were sent to it before he came up with it. Actually, as I mentioned already, he comes up with this pun in reference to defending Jewish customs when they're more liberal than what the text would suggest. In particular, the idea of Chadash, the new grains. However, he then, when he latches on to this pun, he uses it only in the direction of stringency. As I said, the real effort, really, the problem, is how to read the reformers out of Judaism when what they're arguing seems to have sources. And I don't think anyone can really argue with my statement that if you read their responsa, you see that they are stretching matters. You see that they are trying, they're grasping at straws to declare what the reformers are doing forbidden. And the truth is, there's a big difference. If someone, let's say in Krakow in the year 1600, comes up with a radical idea, you look at it one way. In the early 19th century, when people who are not that observant are soliciting opinions from rabbis outside of Germany, there's a reason why they didn't solicit the local rabbis, you know that they're up to no good. And therefore, we already saw the Chasam Sofer was not bound by the absolute correct answers. That is, even if he couldn't prove something 100%, if he had a sense that it was wrong or right, that was enough. All the Gedolim sensed that the reformers were moving in a negative direction, and the halakhic argumentation is really secondary. From their perspective, you know the expression, even the devil can quote scripture. Even the reform leaders can quote halachot. But the reason they're quoting these halachot from the rabbinic position was in order to tear down Judaism, traditional Judaism. And I have to admit that they were correct in that. Okay, well, how then did the Chatham Sofer and the others respond? They make a distinction, for example, when it comes to music. They say, the Chasam Sofer says, that there's no mitzvah to rejoice during prayers, during davening. There is a mitzvah to rejoice with the bride and groom. And therefore, while it's permissible to play music for a bride and groom, it's not permissible to play music in davening. Of course, you could ask. If this music during davening, the organ, gives you more kavanah, what's so terrible? That's why I say the arguments were not so strong. Could the traditionalists adopted a different approach? Maybe. Maybe they could have compromised and said the music could only be played like in Prague before Shabbos, not during Shabbos per se. That is, they play Mizmor Shir one time with the music and one time not. It's hard to know what categories to put the reformers in. The Chasam Sofer, also, he doesn't exactly know where to put them. He decides to put them in the category, because they're clearly Jewish, he puts them in the category of carrots. your karaites. That's the closest parallel. What's a karaite? A karaite is one from Jewish stock, biologically Jewish, who rejects rabbinic authority. And that's what the Chasam Sofer argues. He later goes further and claims that if we were permitted, we would have to, just like the Karaites, forbid intermarriage completely with the Reformers. Let me tell you one more approach. Oh, before I go on to that, what about prayer in the vernacular? The Chasam Sofer and others as well argue that while it is okay for one who doesn't understand the Hebrew to privately read the prayers, and that's what the earlier sources were referring to, it's not okay for the Chazan or for the community to daven in anything other than Hebrew. This makes perfect sense. We can understand this. Can you imagine if everyone prayed in the local language? If we went to France, we wouldn't understand the davening. It makes sense. We can understand it. We can appreciate it. However, the question remains, is that really what the Mishnah meant when it says prayer can be in any language? Did they really mean that if a group of people get together for whatever reason, they don't know Hebrew, and they decide to read the prayers in the vernacular, that you can't do that? From the rabbinic position, the Chasam Sofer's position, it's the Chazan should recite it in Hebrew even if no one understands it. That's the argument. Then the Chasam Sofer offers a different perspective, which I think helps clarify everything we're speaking about now. And his model became very popular. The Chasam Sofer says that in disputes, he says this in a letter to Reb Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, the Maariv Chayes. He says, when we are disputing with Reform, he's really speaking about people who are in this tshuva, he's not speaking necessarily per se about Reform. He's speaking about people who are not careful with Jewish law, which obviously also applies to Reform. He says that we raise the level of an Isur. We raise the level of a prohibition. What does that mean, raise the level of a prohibition? The Chasam Sofer understands him to be saying, and not just the Chasam Sofer, many people who follow, and I'm sorry, not just Maariv Chayes, many others, what the Chasam Sofer is saying is that in the midst of a polemic, if you want to get people to follow the law, it is permissible to say about a rabbinic prohibition that it really is a Torah prohibition. You are allowed to lie about the status of a prohibition to keep people in line, because we know that when people hear that something's a Torah prohibition, they take it more seriously than if you say that it's a rabbinic prohibition. The truth is, I don't think the Chasam Sofer is saying this. What the Chasam Sofer is saying, in my opinion, is that he's dealing with an issue, and the Ramban holds that it's a Torah prohibition, and everyone else holds it's a rabbinic prohibition. And the Chasam Sofer says we can raise the level of the prohibition and say that it's a Torah prohibition, even though we don't hold like the Ramban. Since the Ramban says it, we can rely on the Ramban. So he's not actually making it up out of whole cloth. He's simply saying that in this case, it's okay for us to say that it's a Torah prohibition. The Maariv Chayes doesn't like this at all. The Maariv Chayes says that you're violating the prohibition against adding onto the Torah, that you are not allowed to say that a Torah rabbinic prohibition is a Torah prohibition. And this becomes a great dispute. If you look at the article on women's prayer groups that appeared about 15 years ago by the Frimmer brothers, Dov and Aryeh Frimmer, very long and comprehensive article, you can find it online, about women's prayer groups. They have an appendix in the back in which they take up this problem. Is it permissible to say that something is forbidden when it's not forbidden? Why is this relevant to their article? Because you had many people arguing against women's prayer groups and saying they're forbidden. And the suspicion of many was that really, while the rabbis were saying that it's forbidden, the rabbis didn't really think that it was technically forbidden, because what could actually be the prohibition for a group of women to come together and recite some prayers? but rather they wanted the people not to do it because they thought that it was a negative force. They thought it was going to advance feminism, all sorts of reasons. They thought it was wrong, political reasons, metahawk reasons, whatever you call it, policy. And therefore, they declared it forbidden. So the question is it permissible for a rabbi to say that something is forbidden when it is not, if the rabbi feels it is necessary? In my forever forthcoming book, I deal with this in great length, because I have a whole long chapter about is it permissible to lie. And you will see there, big guns, important authorities on both sides of the issue. We even had this in my very community. I heard this from one of the rabbis, that one of the rabbis wanted to declare that it was forbidden to play basketball on Shabbos, because he didn't like the fact that people were playing ball on Shabbos. And another rabbi said that if you do that, then he's going to declare that it's permissible to play basketball on Shabbos, because for Ashkenazim at least, because Rav Moshe Isserles says so, and that you have to be honest with people, and if you want them not to play ball, you have to explain to them why it's not in the Shabbos spirit, etc. But you have many, many examples of this dispute. Do the rabbis have the authority? I'll just give you one example, which I think you'll find interesting, which I talk about in the book, the forthcoming book. There was a rabbi in America in the 40s. His name is Russoff, and he was asked this question, and he publishes this in his responsa. A man whose seventh day of Shiva asked him, his seventh day of Shiva was Shabbos, asked him, is there Shiva on Shabbos? Now think of America in the 1940s. You had a lot of ignorant people, but a lot of people with Jewish hearts and wanting to do the right thing. But for many of these people, the laws of Avelos are more important than the laws of Shabbos. Of course, it's not the case, but they thought it was the case. Why did this person want to know if Shiva extended to Shabbos? Because if you don't sit Shiva on Shabbos, if there's no mourning on Shabbos, he wanted to go back to a store. He had been out for a week, and he wanted to go back. He worked on Shabbos. He did not work during Shiva, because Shiva is Shiva. But Shabbos, he works on Shabbos. You know, he go like so many Jews. They went to Shabbos morning services. You had early morning minyanim in the Lower East Side, 7 a.m., so people could get out and by 9 o'clock be in their shops. So Rabbi Russoff ponders the question. If he tells them that there's no mourning on Shabbos, the person's going to go be Machal Shabbos. Is it permissible for him to lie to the person and tell them there is mourning on Shabbos? Now, I don't think today you'd ever have a question like this, because knowledge is too much out there. But he was asked this question, and he goes through the back and forth, and in the end, the rabbi concludes that it is permissible to lie to the congregant, and what he tells them is that while you don't have to, you don't have to dress as a mourner, and you don't have to wear, you wear your normal shoes and everything like that, he says there still is mourning, and you are forbidden to leave the house on the seventh day, even though it's Shabbos. So here you have an example of where the rabbi lies to the congregant because he feels that it's his responsibility to keep him from violating Shabbos. And as I said, this goes back and forth, and you can get more details if you want. The Chasam Sofer argues that it is permissible to at least twist the truth to a certain extent, if by doing so will keep people on the straight and narrow. The real problem is Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, who was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, he discusses this very question, and he quotes the opinions of people, of rabbis who say you can mislead the masses. It's almost like a Plato's noble lie, that the rulers are, it's okay for them. They're supposed to tell the people things that are not really the truth, because that's the only way to keep them in line. Many rabbis have a rabbinic conception of Plato's noble lie that you have to keep the people stupid, or don't reveal things to the people, because otherwise we can't trust the people. And there's sources for this in the Gemara. This isn't some newfangled thing. There's a whole concept of halacha of ein morin kein, that something is halachic but you don't tell people about it because they're going to take this permission and they'll go too far with it. That's not the same thing as what the Chasam Sofer is talking about or what others, that you actually lie to them. This is just you don't tell them the truth. Actually telling a lie, telling them that something's forbidden when it's not, that's going one step further. But still, the idea that there's that knowledge and that not everyone should have all the knowledge, that concept is found clearly in the Talmud. In fact, if you look in Rav Hirshel Schechter's Nefesh HaRav, or maybe it's Panini HaRav, he claims that Rabbi Soloveitchik is known for permitting Kraft cheese in the 1950s. But he told his students that they were not allowed to tell their balabatim this. And the reason would be because the balabas would then not distinguish between the cheese that the rennet's vegetable, the other type of cheese, and the rav was not concerned with the idea of gvina sakum, which today all the kosher organizations, if any of you, if you go to a supermarket, you'll see cheese, and the non-kosher cheeses that have this thing called the tablet K. We don't eat that today because that's gvina sakum. That's cheese made by a non-Jew, and the psak today, among all the kosher organizations, the standard psak is that our cheese has to actually be made by a Jew having involvement. It's not parallel to Chol V'Yisrael. Chol V'Yisrael just means we don't need to do Chol V'Yisrael anymore, because what does Chol V'Yisrael mean? Chol V'Yisrael means that the concern was that they used pig and smoke or something, so if we have another way of determining that it's cow's milk, that's all you need. That's all that's sufficient. And today, in every civilized country, the government ensures that it's cow's milk. And therefore, Chol V'Yisrael really is irrelevant, as from the halacha, if you want to have a stringency, say fine. But when it comes to cheese, most people's halachic opinion is that it's not just a question of knowledge. That is, we have the knowledge that there's no non-kosher cheese, no non-kosher stuff in the cheese, but that cheese is sort of like meat, that you actually need to have an action, a maisa. Just like you can't say, well, this cow is a kosher animal, I can eat the cow. It needs to be shechted, so too cheese has to have a Jewish involvement in it. But the Rav didn't hold this way. The Rav held that cheese was no different than milk, it's just a question of knowledge, and since Kraft cheese, at least in those days, I don't know what it is today, was only vegetable rennet, you could eat cheese, and the tablet K, this Rabbi Safra, that's what he relies on. But as far as I know, there's no one today eats that cheese, and it's not regarded as reliable. Not that it's treif in the sense that there's anything animal in it, but it's treif because it's gvina sakum. And as I said, Rav Schechter thought, quotes the Rav as saying that this idea is something the masses shouldn't know about. Now, the organ becomes the symbol of the difference between the Jew, the Orthodox, and the Reform. The organ becomes central. Every Reform synagogue in Germany has an organ. And for a long time, I don't know when it stopped, but for a long time, at least probably into the 20th century, the organ was played by a non-Jew. I can tell you that in Budapest, the Reform in Budapest, to this day, a non-Jew plays the organ. They rely on this decision. The Reform in Budapest is not real Reform. It's more like right-wing conservative. The other area, and there's a lot I could say about the organ, but we don't need to go into it now. The other area that it's important in terms of understanding the Chasam Sofer's view of Reform is that he saw this as part and parcel of an attempt to become part of general German society. And we've spoken about this already, just to summarize, for those who don't recall, if you remember, those who are with us, the Chasam Sofer argues against emancipation. This is not a good thing. Think what reform is. Reform is a recognition that society is changing, and we're going to modernize what we do, because now society is different and we're changing in all aspects of our life. We're also going to change in our religious life. For the Chatam Sofer, we want to live as second-class citizens. We do not want to be accepted. we do not want emancipation. And the Chasam Sofer is really living in a pre-modern world. I mentioned last class, he's not sure who's correct, Copernicus or Ptolemy. He writes to show you just a sense of how different he is than, let's say, Hirsch, who's not much after him. The Chasam Sofer wonders, he believes that you really should have a Jewish medical school. He wants there to be a Jewish medical school. But why? He doesn't think, he questions whether Jews studying in a non-Jewish medical school is advantageous because Jewish bodies are different than non-Jewish bodies. Jews eat kosher food. And therefore, how can the Jewish body be the same as the non-Jewish body? You need to have people looking just at Jewish bodies. I mean, the idea that medicine would be different depending on a Jew versus a non-Jew is a very medieval way of looking at things. And this is something the Chasam Sofer shared. The Chasam Sofer, just briefly, because I see we have 3 minutes, he was confronted with this problem because the non-Jewish rulers are extending emancipation to the Jews. How then can you argue against it? The Chasam Sofer has a whole sermon on this, and his response is basically, we have to be thankful to tell the non-Jews how thankful we are, but deep down we have to be very upset. He compares it to if a king exiles his sons because they did something wrong from the kingdom. And after a certain amount of time, the king decides to build one of his exiled sons a beautiful palace in the exile. On the one hand, the son has to be thankful to his father for building him this beautiful palace. On the other hand, the son also has to cry because this means that his son, his father is not going to be calling him back to the kingdom anytime soon because he's building him this beautiful palace. The fact that now we're being welcomed by the non-Jews and life is becoming good, this is a sign for the Chasam Sofer that it's now time for us to become comfortable in the Galut. And this can only mean that our redemption is even further away. Because traditionally the idea is that after we're going to suffer, and then God is going to bring the redemption. But now the non-Jews are welcoming us. And this is also going to lead many Jews into assimilation. That's a completely different issue that the Chasam Sofer speaks about. But the idea that now God is telling us that you're going to now be able to plant roots. God has put it into the hearts of the Gentile rulers to welcome us, to allow us to become citizens. For the Chasam Sofer, what this means is that redemption is even further and further away. And he says, well, I see it's already 10 o'clock, so we'll end here. We're going to, next class, we pick up with some more, really the reform aspect we'll speak about a little more, but major ideas of the Chasam Sofer, as well as his historical significance. We've spoken about views of reform. When I say that he sets the stage for the battle against reform, what I mean is as follows. There were those, not among the people in that book, Ego Divrei Rebbe, but others who thought that maybe we can make some sort of compromise. Don't be such in such opposition. The Chasam Sofer bans sermons in the vernacular as a reform. We'll see that others thought, no, you know, that's a good reform. That's a reform with a small r. If we could have sermons in the vernacular and keep people on our side, that's a good thing to do. The Chasam Sofer, though, is more happy with a small group of strongly committed than a larger group of wishy-washy. So this Hungarian approach to reform, take-no-prisoners attitude, complete opposition, that goes back to the Chasam Sofer really pushing this approach. In Germany, as we know and as we've seen, a very different way of doing this. Rav Shimshon von Hirsch's approach and the German Orthodox approach was reform with a small r, to try to remove the legs from the reform movement. The reform movement was happy to say that the only way you could be a modern Jew was to be reform. Because look at the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer has said that we should be in the ghetto and we can't be involved in modern civilizations. And all that leaves is a small community. The reform are very happy with this. Comes along Hirsch and argues no, that we can be cultured and we can speak in Hochdeutsch and we can go to the university and we can do all this and be committed to Torah and traditional Judaism. It's a completely different approach to how to deal with reform. It is not chadash asur min haTorah. It's not that what is new is forbidden by the Torah. It's just the opposite. It's that we take what is new, and if it's not in opposition to halacha, we assimilate it into our Jewish practices and be a better Jew for it. But the Chassam Sofer's position, which really leads directly to Hungarian extremism, becomes, the counter to this. What will become significant is when we deal with the Chassam Sofer's son, because the Chassam Sofer's son has to make a decision. Do you go left? Do you go the direction of German Orthodoxy? Or do you stay with my father's position? And the Chassam Sofer's son, if you can believe it, decides to abandon, that is the Ksav Sofer, he decides to abandon his father's outlook and hires Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer to create a German Orthodox community in Pressburg. It's an amazing thing. And the response to him was vicious and severe by the Chassam Sofer's own students. The response to the son of the Chassam Sofer, as we'll see, was very strong. But this is all to come in the next couple of weeks. I think we still have 2 more weeks of dealing with the Chassam Sofer, and then we'll move on directly to his son and talk about what I just was referring to. So I hope my voice is better. It's about 95% better. I will end here. If there's any questions, we'll take them now. See, we have a smaller group this time, I think because they forgot to send out the reminder. I hope they haven't yet sent out the tape from last week also, either. Usually they do that within a couple of days, so I hope they'll get on to that. For those who came late, I want to show you again right now the Chatham Sofer's grave, together with a number of other sages from our trip last summer, underground. Totally redone about 10 years ago. It's an architectural wonder. You can find articles about this online, how they built this thing. Okay, I do not see any questions. I will stay on for 30 more seconds. If not, we will pick up next week. Daniel Prostitz, that's to the right of the Chassam Sofer there, he brought the Chassam Sofer in. He was on the Bastion, and he was influential in bringing the Chassam Sofer to Pressburg, to Bratislava. Okay, well, with that, I will say good night. Wish you all a good week, and if there's any questions or comments, email them to me, and I'll get to them next week. Good night, everyone.